Today is Monday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
In an interview with CNN Turkey, which aired Sunday, Maduro said the country's high court and judiciary authorities will determine if Guaido violated Venezuela's laws.
Also ahead, President Trump sees less than 50% of a chance of a deal to fund the border wall. We'll have all this on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump says he sees less than a 50% chance congressional negotiators can put together a deal to fund a southern border wall that he will accept. Trump told the Wall Street Journal yesterday there are some very good people on the bipartisan negotiating team, but he said he doubts he will accept less than the $5.7 billion in wall funding he has been demanding, adding, "I have to do it right." The president also said he doubts he would accept citizenship for the so-called Dreamers as part of an agreement. He said the future of immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children is a separate subject to be taken up at a separate time. Trump said another government shutdown is certainly an option if he does not get what he wants to build a wall. He also said he could declare a national emergency, which would allow him to fund the wall without congressional approval, a tactic Democrats are sure to challenge in the courts. Well, for a look at what's next for the president and Congress, joining me live in the studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Kim.
Well, Jim, do you think President Trump and Congress will be able to negotiate a border security agreement now that the government has reopened?
Well, I think we can say a couple of things about that. The president's hand may be a little weaker now. He had to back off on the shutdown, and I think that the Democrats came out of this looking a bit empowered, especially the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So the question is, will there be any money for any sort of barrier-type structure for the southern border? And there's this special committee that's been put together, bipartisan committee, to try to work that out. As you noted at the top of the program here, the president doesn't sound very optimistic that that's going to get to that point. And I think, you know, although they have invoked the threat of another shutdown, I think politically that's looking kind of unfeasible right now. The president's poll ratings dropped significantly during this shutdown period. I was just looking earlier today. His approval ratings went below 40% in five recent polls. That is not good. And I think that was a main contributor to him realizing that he had to sort of find a way to get out of the shutdown before it did him any more damage.
Did that poll include both his Republicans and Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, Republicans were hanging with him. But I think we saw in the votes in the Senate last week, particularly on the Democratic proposal to reopen the government, even though neither proposal was able to get enough votes, you had actually more senators, including some Republicans, siding with the Democrats. And that was a sign right there that some of the Democrats are not willing to, some of the Republicans are not willing to follow the president blindly over a cliff anymore.
So what do you think they will settle on as a reasonable solution for both parties, or will you think the president have to do an executive order?
Well, right now, there's the Democrats want to talk about border security. The president wants to talk about specifically wall funding. Is there some way in there they can kind of mask their differences and come to an agreement? Maybe a little bit of money for a structure? We'll see. If Democrats do feel emboldened, as I think they do, they may want to stick with their initial demand of no money for the wall. I think if we get to a stalemate situation, this sort of declaration of national emergency the president has talked about is likely, but even Republicans have been warning him against that. They don't like the precedent it sets for presidential power. And so, it's also likely to be challenged in the courts, and that could extend the battle for months, if not years. And the president, let's remind everyone, wants this wall victory because he thinks it's an essential part of his reelection hopes for 2020.
And just real quick, just looking at the shutdown itself from an economic standpoint, how did it really impact the U.S.?
Yeah, there's already projections of a few billion dollars lost because of this. And I don't know what your experience coming into work today. I sensed a lot of energy in the city, people coming back to work. So they're grateful for that. But the long-term sort of ramifications of the shutdown, both politically and economically, we're still sorting through.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. It's VOA National Correspondent Jim Malone with me here in the studio. Well, Venezuela's embattled leader Nicolas Maduro has rejected an EU ultimatum calling for new elections in his country. In a televised interview aired yesterday, he said the opposition leader Juan Guaido has violated the Constitution by proclaiming himself interim president, but he has agreed to a dialogue with the opposition. VOA's Zlatica Hoc has more.
In an interview with CNN Turkey, which aired Sunday, Maduro said the country's high court and judiciary authorities will determine if Guaido violated Venezuela's laws. He rejected the demand by the European Union to hold a new and democratic election, or else Europe will recognize Guaido as Venezuela's interim president.
Venezuela will continue on its path. Fortunately, we don't depend on Europe and those arrogant, overbearing attitudes looking down on us because we are inferior to them. That European elite is finished with. That European elite doesn't represent the European people. The leaders of Europe are sycophants, kneeling behind the policies of Donald Trump. All of Europe is kneeling at the feet of U.S. President Donald Trump. It's as simple as that, and especially over Venezuela.
President Maduro was sworn in for a second term earlier this month after an election widely considered as fraudulent. The United States and most regional countries, as well as Israel, have recognized Guaido as interim president until a new one is elected by a democratic vote. Maduro has cut diplomatic ties with Washington and ordered U.S. diplomats to leave the country, but has later rescinded that order.
I have sent many messages to Mr. Trump, but I think he is drowning in domestic problems. And I think looks down on us. He looks down on all of Latin America and the Caribbean.
The United States has warned Maduro against using force to quell the opposition or attack U.S. diplomatic personnel. Russia has accused the United States of fomenting unrest in Venezuela.
The United States is painting a picture of a confrontation between the Maduro regime and the people of Venezuela. This picture is far from reality. In spite of everything, the leader of Venezuela obviously has broad support among the people.
The United Nations called for a dialogue as a solution to the political crisis, but Venezuelans are divided on the issue.
As Venezuelans, I think we should not be violent. I think that a dialogue will help us to move forward as Venezuelans, as a society, and a country that we are.
First, how many times has there been dialogue and the government, or what is called the government, has not respected the dialogue? Are we going to do the same again? No. Here, there is no chance of dialogue.
Maduro has the backing of Venezuela's military, but his military attaché in Washington on Saturday urged members of Venezuela's armed forces to recognize Guaido as the legitimate interim president. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
Among the top stories in the world, a Chinese court sentences prominent rights lawyer Wang Guangzheng to 4.5 years in prison on a single charge of subverting state power. The Trump administration lifts sanctions levied on Russian firms linked to the oligarch Oleg Deripaska, an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin, despite a push by the Democrats to keep the sanctions in place. Singapore's Ministry of Health says that information about 5,400 Singaporeans and 8,800 foreigners diagnosed with HIV have been leaked online by an American with a previous record of fraud. And British officials explore strategies for coping with the disruption of Britain leaving the EU without an exit deal. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute. know that certain colors can influence how a food product should taste. Like when we're about to drink a yellow-colored beverage, many of us probably think we're about to taste something tart like lemonade. Penn State University researchers Molly Higgins and John Hayes wanted to find out how people learn to associate colors with tastes and whether they could be taught to link colors with completely different tastes. Over four sessions, the researchers got subjects to sip liquids with new colors they had specifically selected, avoiding any preconceived color taste pairings. Then the subjects were given uncolored liquids and were asked to pair each flavor with the new colors. It turns out the subjects picked the correct color taste match 59% of the time. The research will be published in the journal Food Quality and Preference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The death toll from Friday's dam collapse in southeastern Brazil rose to 58 yesterday, a number sure to climb with at least 300 people feared buried under tons of mud. Rescue operations were briefly halted yesterday as officials feared a breach in another dam in the city of Brumadinho. Residents were told to get ready to evacuate before that dam was found to be secure. The dam, owned by Brazil's Vale Mining Company, collapsed Friday, sending water and mud over hundreds of mine workers enjoying a lunch break. Brazilian judicial authorities have frozen some $3 billion of global mining giant Vale's assets since Friday. The company has also been hit with multiple fines as it comes under scrutiny for regulatory violations and pollution in the wake of the disaster. Well, ISIS has claimed responsibility for the twin bombings yesterday at a cathedral in the southern Philippines that killed at least 20 people and wounded 81. The government has promised to hunt down the attackers and said in a statement, until every killer is brought to justice and put behind bars. The first bomb exploded during mass inside the cathedral in Jolo in the province of Sulu. The second blast happened moments later as government forces responded to the first explosion. Members of the military and civilians are among the dead. Jolo is situated in a mostly Muslim region of the predominantly Catholic Philippines. The blast came just days after the region held an autonomy referendum, which was overwhelmingly approved. Sulu province voters, however, rejected the autonomy vote, but it still will be part of the new entity. Sulu is home to the Islamist militant group Abu Sayyaf, which has been blamed for a number of deadly bombings. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Roger Baker, Senior VP of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform. He asked Baker if he thought there was any connection between the results of the autonomy referendum.
I believe the two issues are connected. When you look at the way in which the Philippine government has been working to slowly erode the militancy in the southern Philippines, when they strike a deal with one of the large groups, usually fairly soon after or in the process of striking that deal, one of the smaller offshoots or one of the smaller groups actually carries out activities to try to undermine it. And when we look at the way in which this referendum went, Sulu is a place that voted narrowly against joining the referendum. The Abu Sayyaf group has been active within that part of the southern Philippines, and this may in part be their attempt to undermine the ability of the government to peacefully pull off the follow-up to the referendum.
Could they be successful by what they have done?
It's not clear that they're going to be entirely successful by what they've done. The larger Muslim groups, the MILF, has condemned the activity, condemned this attack. They've worked for quite a long time to try to find some way to gain a greater role and responsibility and authority in the southern Philippines. So I don't think that this is going to completely undermine the referendum and undermine the path towards creating the new BARM. But it does demonstrate that when these things happen, you don't instantly have peace just because you've had a referendum or just because you brought a group in. This is a very long-running conflict, and there are a lot of different opinions and views on how the future should be shaped out in the southern Philippines. If we look at this, I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that when we look at the southern Philippines, it's not a single group. It's a variety of groups. And depending upon which island they're on, which part of Mindanao or which part of the Sulu Archipelago they're on, these are different subgroups, different sub-ethnicities, different affinities And therefore, you don't have a single agreement, even when you bring one of the larger groups into the fold.
What do you think will happen now? I hate to ask people to look into their crystal balls, but sometimes we have to do that. With your experiences in reading and knowing about this group and these groups, do you think there will be more attacks, similar attacks?
I think that there's going to be more attacks, but we also note that the government has set up a new task force in the southern Philippines to accelerate its operations against the Abu Sayyaf. So this is a group that is facing a fairly extreme pressure from the government. They are losing some of their ability to gain support and succor from some of the larger Islamist groups and former militant groups in the southern Philippines. I don't think that they're going to entirely disappear, but certainly we're going to see factions of the Abu Sayyaf being hunted down and other factions trying to continue this fight and carry out additional attacks.
Do you think that the government of the Philippines has enough ability, weapons, wherewithal to fight this and to be victorious?
I think in the long run, but look, this is a hundreds-year-old conflict. It's not going to be solved purely by military force. And one thing I think if you look at the Philippine government that they've expected and their policy slowly but steadily has evolved, and that is in the southern Philippines, keep breaking the militancy down into smaller and smaller groups. And ultimately, it becomes manageable. It may never be fully resolved. At least if you can fracture the larger groups, if you can bring them into some sort of government arrangement, if they can have some role of power and authority, that's going to co-opt them into actually trying to track down and hunt down some of these smaller militant groups. And it will reduce the sense of conflict, even if it never completely eliminates it.
That was VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Roger Baker, Senior VP of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform. And coming up on VOA's International Edition, brewing the perfect cup of coffee with blockchain.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Well, blockchain technology, a high-tech way to securely manage and protect data, is best known as the driver of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Now, a U.S. coffee importer is using it to improve the lives of coffee farmers and some of the poorest communities in Central America. Faith Lapidus reports.
Ivan Herrera grows coffee in the hills above Santa Rosa de Lima, 40 kilometers outside Guatemala's capital city. She's proud of her crop.
We're going to pick a great coffee. That's what we've been working towards, and this year we're seeing the result of 2 years' hard work.
Like most of the world's coffee farmers, Herrera used to sell her product on the International Coffee Futures Market, where buyers agree to purchase the beans at a predetermined price for a future delivery date. That depresses prices and leaves them vulnerable to currency fluctuation. But now, Herrera sells directly to an independent coffee roaster in the United States and gets a premium price. The system is the brainchild of Paul Tupper and his brother Scott, who harnessed a successful blockchain technology business in Seattle to tackle the issue of environmental sustainability in the developing world.
Anyone who's a fan of coffee and many other goods has seen the proliferation of standards and certifications that are out on the market. And it can be confusing for a consumer. Blockchain can lay on top of all of this as a way to verify what's actually going on financially and socially.
Blockchain technology creates a ledger to record, manage, and confirm transactions transparently and verifiably by all stakeholders, such as the coffee grower, the importer, and the roaster. The brothers' company, Onda Origins, believes that enough consumers will care about where their coffee comes from to pay for quality roasted small batch beans, so it can pay its growers a premium price that exceeds even standard fair trade coffee. The guaranteed higher prices will allow growers like Yvonne Herrera to not only invest in and protect her land, but also pay better wages to her workers, raising the standard of living across her community. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, Indigenous groups are renewing their efforts to change the date of Australia Day. January 26 is a national holiday commemorating the arrival of European settlers more than 230 years ago. But many Aboriginal people believe it marks a time when their lands were stolen and their communities were pushed into poverty and disadvantage that persists to this day. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia Day stirs a heated debate about cultural identity and history. Many Indigenous people refer to January 26 as Invasion Day, when in 1788, the first fleet of British ships arrived in Sydney Harbour. There is a campaign to change the date. May 9 is one suggestion, to acknowledge when Australia's federal parliament first sat in 1901. Brooke Boney, the first Indigenous TV presenter on Australia's popular Today programme, believes the current date is insensitive.
I can't separate the 26th of January from the fact that my brothers are more likely to go to jail than they are to go to school, or that my little sisters and my mum are more likely to be beaten and raped than anyone else's sisters or mum. And that started from that day. So for me, it's a difficult day and I don't want to celebrate it. That's the day that it changed for us, you know? That's the sort of the beginning of what some people would say is the end. That's the turning point.
Despite a vocal campaign, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has no plans to change the date of Australia Day. He has, though, said there could be another national holiday to recognise Aboriginal culture.
Australia Day is the 26th of January. That was the day that Australia's course changed forever. It was 60,000 years of Indigenous history before that, and modern Australia effectively started on that day. You can't change that. That's just what happened. That's just a fact. And I want Australia Day to be even more so a day where all Australians can come together. And so I am open to a chat with the Australian people about how we can better acknowledge Indigenous Australians and our Indigenous peoples.
For many Australians, their National Day is a time to celebrate their modern history with barbecues, concerts and camel races. More than half of all Australians participate in events organised by state governments, local councils and community groups. Over 16,000 migrants become citizens on Australia Day. It's been celebrated since 1935. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil, and you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, has the perception of women as leaders on the continent changed in the last decade? An in-depth discussion on African women and their future as leaders on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.